Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Women Scholars and Professionals podcast. My name is Anne Boyd, and I'll be your host. We at Women Scholars and Professionals are here to support women in their God-given callings into the university and beyond. So if you're a graduate student or a faculty member, an administrator or a student in professional school, a scholar in between jobs, or simply a person who supports women in the academic world, then this podcast is for you. How do we live as true neighbors in a world that is designed more for competition and inequality than compassion? Epidemiologist and professor Dr. Emily Smith joins us on the podcast to discuss her book, The Science of the Good Samaritan: Thinking Bigger About Loving Our Neighbors. During the height of the pandemic, Emily became known as the friendly neighborhood epidemiologist through her social media outlets, where she reached 3 to 4 million people per month during the years 2020 to 2021. I remember those days, and I depended on Emily's updates to help me stay informed about keeping safe while the public health landscape shifted dramatically. It was a real treat to talk with her about her work as an epidemiologist and also to hear her thoughts on life as a faculty member, as a scientist, as a global citizen, and as a faithful Christian working to integrate all parts of her life into a whole. And if you listen to the end of the credits, you'll hear an excerpt from our conversation where Emily shares a little bit more about thriving as a woman in science. So let me tell you a little bit about her. Dr. Emily Smith is an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine and Surgery at Duke University and at the Duke Global Health Institute. Before joining the faculty at Duke University, Dr. Smith spent 4 years at Baylor University in the Department of Public Health and was a research scholar at Duke Global Health Institute for 2 years. Dr. Smith received her PhD in epidemiology from the Gilling School of Global Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill and a Master of Science in Public Health from the University of South Carolina. Emily has been married to her pastor husband for 20 years, and they have 2 fantastic children and 1 spoiled golden retriever. On any normal day, you can find her outside gardening, reading in the hammock with a good cup of coffee, or trying to become a bird watcher. So let's dive right in. We're so glad you're here. Well, Emily, thank you so much for being on the podcast with us.
Thank you for having me. And I love the whole purpose of the podcast and the women's centric. I'm all about it.
Oh, so wonderful. Thank you. Super. Well, we'll talk about that for sure. And of course, I want to talk about your book, The Science of the Good Samaritan. But first, I would love to start by asking you a few questions about your professional life, because as you know, our audience is made up primarily of women connected with academia in one way or another. So I'd love to kind of focus our conversation there. So you are an epidemiologist and a professor. Can you tell us a little bit of the story of your path into this field?
Yeah. Well, and before COVID, a lot of people didn't know what epidemiology was, right? They thought we were skin doctors or bug people, entomology. I'd get that every once in a while. Now people know who we are. So for better, for worse, you know, I grew up in a very, very tiny town in eastern New Mexico. To parents who worked in the church, you know, they were worship leaders, kind of lay leaders there. And I knew that I loved the world, because we were the home where the missionaries would come and stay. So I just grew up hearing their stories. And I thought, I just want to do that. Mm-hmm. But I also loved science. Like 9th grade, I heard about DNA. And I told my teacher in kind of a Taylor Swift fangirl way of, I need to know more. And he handed me, bless him, handed me a college textbook, but didn't tell me it was college. And I just devoured it. I just loved the science and genetics of it. So I thought, well, you know, fast forward to undergrad, let's do pre-med, because I thought the only way to kind of merge the world of maybe mission work or helping people in the globe and science was pre-med. But then I went to Honduras for my first kind of mission trip out of the US with the Mercy ship. And I noticed there that I was asking questions during the outreach that wasn't necessarily about how to treat one-on-one people.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in it, but I was more thinking of questions of why is poverty so high here? Why does this group have a disproportionate amount of diabetes and others don't? And that's inherently epi.
Mm-hmm.
So serendipitously, I had a gap year between going to medical school and I decided to get another degree because it's what we nerds do, right? And it was a it was a master's of public health. And day one of epi, my professor said, epidemiology is finding who is most at risk. So finding the margins and choosing not to walk by. And I just thought, oh, that's it. So I jumped ship, got a PhD, and now here at Duke.
That is great. That's a great story. And you're a professor now.
I am. Yep.
Do you teach med students?
A little bit of both, a med undergrad and grad students. I'm here at the Global Health Institute and the School of Medicine. So it kind of depends on what class.
Okay. Okay. So what have been some of the gifts of your life as a professor? And then what have been some of the challenges?
Oh, I love that question. I've never been asked that question. So let me see if I can do it well. A gift of being a professor, I mean, I'm a mom of two. And so the flexibility of the summers, and I do a lot of global health. Well, I do only global health work. Mm-hmm. And so my kids can go with me to Tanzania. We go every summer now as a family.
Wow.
For, you know, a month or two at a time. And my husband's a pastor, so he's fairly flexible too. So I think that is the biggest gift. I also love teaching because
mm-hmm.
we all probably remember being 18, 19, 20, and just bright-eyed about the world. And to catch them at a phase where you can, you know, pour into that ambition and that wanting to do good in the world, but also give some wisdom on how to do that well. So I love that. The other part is maybe the pitfalls of it. Is that
the challenges. Mm-hmm.
Challenges. I mean, I think the biggest challenge I had in academia is the hustle culture and not giving into it, you know, staying true to my values and who I want to be as a person and as a Christian and as a mom and not feel so rat racy about it. Like have to be working all the time. And so I think that has been the hardest part about academia for me.
Yeah. 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 That's real. We hear about that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So what advice would you have for a young med student or a young grad student or a new faculty person, someone who's maybe a few years earlier in the kind of journey you have? What advice would you give them?
I'd say, remember, it's a long game. You know, I had 10 years of gap years and having children and in multiple degrees where I wasn't doing anything in global health, but just dreaming about it. And so I would say, you know, really listen to your natural inclinations of who you are as a person and just trust that, but then also trust that the timeline can take some time and that that is okay. So part of, you know, I tell all of my students, if any of them are listening, they know what I'm about to say, that you have nothing to lose, but you have nothing to prove either. And so the nothing to lose part is take a risk and go for it. The worst that happens is you fail and you pivot and you try something different. But then the nothing to prove part is that ambition or not rolling you over, you know, with just trying to go for your goals and you're loved just the way that you are. And to try to help them lean into that instead of the imposter syndrome that tends to be pervasive for especially women in academics.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's such a challenge for all of us, really, that balance of accepting ourselves as beloved and okay, just how we are, but also having the sense of safety where we can pursue our goals. It's tough. It's a tough balance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really is. And then being a person of faith in an Ivy League academic, I mean, the rules are different. The anchors are different. The centering and motivations can be quite different. So it's hard to hang on to that unless you, you know, especially if you don't have people around you that can help anchor you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, conversations like this, I think, are helpful for our younger listeners. And so I'm glad to be able to talk with you and hear your experience.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to talk with you about your book. So let's get into it. The title is The Science of the Good Samaritan, Thinking Bigger About Loving Our Neighbors. And it's such a fascinating book. It really weaves together history and personal reflection and scripture and science and your experience of the pandemic. So I would like to start by asking about the title, which I thought was a really great one. Can you say a little bit about the way the parable of the Good Samaritan offers a framework for your book?
Yeah, for sure. Well, in the title, The Science of the Good Samaritan, that is kind of the eureka moment that I had that first day of Epi, you know, when he is saying that that's the, you know, we quantify who's on the margins and then choose not to walk, choose not to do something, basically. And I thought that's the science of the Good Samaritan. So I've kind of hung on to that sentiment for a long time until the book came out. But it is anchored in the story of the Good Samaritan story that most of us are familiar with. And even you don't even have to be of a Christian faith to kind of know this story. But I think I had read it so many times that I missed some of the nuances of it. And so I went back and read it. And it's, you know, the story is this man who goes up to Jesus and basically asks, who's my neighbor? And we don't know if he's asking it with a voice inflection of a gotcha. But right. I kind of read it as a, what's good enough to be good enough? You know, can I give 10% of my tithe and go to a food pantry, you know, a couple times a year? Is that okay? And being the good Jesus that he is, he doesn't answer the question directly. He does a story and then a question after. And it's the story of this man who's on the side of the road. And, you know, the two people of privilege and power at the time, the Levite and the priest, walk by. But a Samaritan comes by and actually helps the man. And the part that I missed in the story is what he does after, because he takes care of the man, but then he puts him up in a place to recover and then pays for it all.
Yeah.
And that part, I don't know how many times I've told this story so far, but it makes me teary because of the medical impoverishment, the holistic view of what health means to that Samaritan man. And then Jesus turns around to the initial guy and says, now, who was the neighbor? And there's two different questions that look quite similar. Who is my neighbor and who was the neighbor? But I think in practice, there are two different worldviews, their postures. It's one that has already been enacted upon versus one of asking what's okay to just, you know, how can I get by and kind of check that box off? So for me, in my own work, as the science of the Good Samaritan, as being epidemiology, I mean, that's just what I think that science is. It's how to be the second type of question. You know, how do I live a life of neighboring rather than asking the type of what's okay to just be good, a good person, and then get by?
Right. Yeah. And it's so difficult sometimes because the needs are so great. And
yeah.
I really appreciate the way you don't shy away from talking about the huge needs there are in the world and the way that we all need to grapple with that question.
Yeah, but I did that. You know, the book has three parts: centering, cost, and courage. Good C's, because I'm a Baptist pastor's wife. Try to make it. But the first one is centering, and that's the hard part. That's what made the Samaritan just intrinsically stop, while the other two didn't. I wish that I had a 10-step plan, but we just don't. And so centering is more of that heart work. And it gets back to the not shying away from the hard realities of our world. And I saw that during the pandemic. I saw people who had never heard of things like structural racism or equity. Every time I would use that word, those were some of the most viral posts in good and very bad ways.
Right.
And I realized, gosh, I don't think people understand what systemic racism, structural violence, equity actually is. Because I think if you do, you realize they're holy words because they're showing us where heaven isn't quite on earth yet. So the first part of the book, I wanted to just kind of go there in a way that is not threatening, but, you know, perhaps challenging to us.
Yeah. I mean, in the first part of the book, you get into a lot of history which was kind of a surprise to me, you know, as I started reading it. But I really appreciated the perspective. Maybe say a little bit more about your choice to include all of that history.
Yeah, well, I'm a huge reader and just a bit of a nerd all around anyway. So I love history. I love the books about history. But the more I started working on the ground, I work in Somaliland, which is in the Horn of Africa. It's the third poorest country in the world. It's actually that part of the world is in the news right now because it borders Yemen across the Gulf of Aden. So people have probably heard about it now. But if you go back in to 1885, there was this huge table where 14 countries, all high-income country leaders, came together. They were all white men at the time, because that's, you know, that's just what it was. At the back of that room, there was a map of the continent of Africa. And the whole point of that meeting is called the Berlin Conference, or also the Great Scramble, was to splice and dice the continent into colonial powers. So who gets what part of the continent? But it was fairly unnatural how they spliced it. If you look at Lake Victoria, it looks like someone just put their pencil down and just went straight down and across. I mean, it was really unnatural. It cut up about 10 to 15% of the just organic countries, ethnicities. Two of the men had been to Africa, and none of the others had, and no one from the continent was there. The Sultan of Zanzibar asked to come and wasn't given entry. So when you fast forward, you go through colonialism and all of that entailed. In the 60s, 1960, most countries started getting their independence. And I use that in quotes, air quotes here, because something like Somaliland, Britain did leave in 1960, but what they also left was the infrastructure, the healthcare professionals, the military protection was all British. And so there wasn't this coming alongside the country to actually develop their own. So that country went through a brutal civil war over the next 30 years that decimated the country, which when you fast forward to nowadays, it's kind of not surprising it's the third poorest country in the world, with some of the worst health indicators for some of the kids and mothers dying in childbirth. So I just wanted to tell people, I mean, as much as we're a product of our own story and our own history, so are countries. And that can perhaps help people not shame poor people. I use that in quotes too, poor countries. You know, many people are just born into situations and countries that are not of their own fault, nor their parents, nor even their grandparents. But there's a history, like at the Great Scramble, that has some modern day ramifications, especially when it comes to poverty.
Yeah. Well, the way that you talk and the way that you write, we can tell that you have kind of an overarching perspective on a lot of these big issues. And it was what made your writing in the pandemic so helpful for so many of us, myself included. But as I read your own reflection on your experience with the pandemic, I was really sobered and grieved to learn that your work to educate people about science and about compassion and about racism, all of this led to threats that were sent to your family. And you had a really intensely stressful time that ended up affecting your health. And golly, I mean, it feels like a pretty scary world right now. Yeah. as we approach those kinds of issues and just thinking about doing something for the good of the world, resulting in such pushback. So I guess I'm wondering, do you have any further thoughts about how we can take small steps to find common ground in our current political climate? And especially when the stakes are really high, we're trying to find solutions to things like climate change and global health issues. You write all about this.
Especially in an election year, right? Of how to find common ground. There's one chapter called Getting Along is Not the Goal that is about this issue. And it's knowing, I think first recognizing that when we say, how can we find common ground, or let's all get along, or can we just bring everybody to the table? I think we need to recognize that getting along, or the common ground, that denotes that both sides, or three sides, or whoever is coming to the table, has to have an equal voice, and even historically. And that has not been the case at all, for sure. And so common ground, especially right now, is not just coming together and letting people talk. I think it's really recognizing, the history of some of these complexities, who has been listened to, who hasn't, who's been given the microphones at tables, and who's not even been. I mean, when you think of the Great Scramble, it was pretty very clear at like a true physical table. So I think we have to recognize that it's not like black and white makes gray. For a lot of the conversations historically, there's been a saturation point of only one of those colors and not the other. So I think we have to get the middle right first and then have some common ground. And you know what I learned by all of that that you just talked about during the pandemic? That's the middle part of the book. And it's only two chapters, it's very short. When you read it, though, you will probably recognize if it might still be messy. Like to me, when I was reading the audiobook of this part, I could tell that there were still sentences and paragraphs that were just messy. Like I just couldn't, I needed just to get it on paper and get it over with. So I think you will hear that. I didn't put it in there though to be a tell-all, because this is, it's just not me. It's not worth it. But I wanted people to know, when you start speaking out against inequities or racism and you take a stand, there will likely be a cost. And I bet you for many people who are listening, there's already been a cost, especially in churches, like how people responded or didn't to the pandemic. There's likely been a cost. And for some like me, it's been incredibly visceral, threats at my house to my children, and we moved. I got incredibly sick. I hope that the cost is not that high, but I wish I would have been a little bit more prepared for it. Because now, when we want to find common ground or people want to have a conversation, I am much more wise on who I say yes to or who I say no to, and that we don't have to talk to everybody. If you can kind of say no or walk out of a room or recognize what's going to be heard or not. So it is it's a wisdom moment for me to know that.
Well, one of the things that I loved about your book was the way you weaved your faith into the whole thing. And I was struck particularly by one part in chapter 7 where you talk about the idea of acknowledging the sacredness in others and living with a sense of accompanying others along the journey. The illustrations in that chapter point toward this as a beautiful way to identify with those who are in poverty. And it also occurred to me that this idea could be really helpful in our professions as well as teachers and doctors and professionals who are working with someone who it's maybe hard to identify with. So could you talk a little bit about how we can integrate this idea of acknowledging the sacred ground of the other into our work?
Yes, and that's a quote from the Pope. When we recognize that sacredness, we take off our shoes because the ground is holy. Oh my goodness, such a beautiful picture. But it points to the notion of accompaniment, of accompanying somebody, which is different than taking care of or lording over or power. Because when you accompany, it is this picture of walking beside somebody, or entering in or bearing witness to something in a way where there's equality, there's not a hierarchy. There's also a ton of compassion and empathy. And so that when you recognize the sacred in the other and you take off your shoes because the ground is holy, that's acknowledging their image of godness that anybody has, regardless of what they look like or if they're hurt or money or any of these, descriptors that are a power play or a privilege play. So one of the stories I tell in that chapter is in Honduras, I went out with some of the group on a medical outreach day where we go really far out into the most rural places. And I couldn't do anything except make balloon animals for the kids. I wasn't medical at that time. I just would hang with the kids and I couldn't speak the language. So we'd play with them. But in another community, there was a time where we went to a hut where some of the family members already knew people on our team. And I heard them say that one of the main family members, the breadwinner, the father, had died of AIDS, and they couldn't afford a coffin. And so he was still there. I mean, and there's children everywhere. And I remember feeling like that moment seemed to just stand still for a minute, because my team, the team that I was with that knew the family and could speak the language, just revered the family in a way where they paid for a coffin. They arranged the funeral. It was holy ground. And this was a family that looked very different than I had ever seen before. So I think when we do that, and number one, we don't have shoes. And so there's a quietness, there's like a slowness of bearing witness to people's whatever their, state that they're in. But then there's also recognizing that image of God, and that changes us. I think that changes our heart on serving people when we have a heart that recognizes that.
Yeah. One of the things that I really appreciated in your book, and we've mentioned this before, is that but that your work as an epidemiologist demands that you face a lot of painful injustices and public health crises, and you tackle them head on. You tell us so many stories. You talk in the book about COVID, certainly, but you also talk about things like the inequality in accessibility to surgery around the world and other examples of structural violence. And I really appreciated in chapter 19, you were talking about choosing the battles we need to fight. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because I don't know, I guess as I talk with faculty, I think that we all feel like we kind of carry the weight of the world on our shoulders. So tell us more about how you make those choices.
Yeah, and chapter 19 is in the third part of the book where it's all about courage. We've centered ourselves as well as we can. We understand there's a cost, and then the courage to actually live out as a neighbor. And so one of them, especially 19, is the Nehemiah chapter. It's the wisdom chapter on choosing what you just said, choosing what you're going to be about. And I did that specifically because a lot of us, especially in faith, a lot of women, you hear about inequities or climate change or poverty or food insecurity, and you just are going, yes. And it's and then it gets overwhelming because you can't do it all. And so I wanted to put this chapter in there. Number one, that's okay, because we're never supposed to do it all, but what do we do? And Nehemiah, if you look at the end of chapter one, he has this thing where he says, I'm a cupbearer to the king. And in my Bible, I wrote beside it descriptors of whatever life I am in that time. So in 2016, I was a PhD student. 2008, I'm a new mom. Like, I'm a cupbearer to the king. Who are you? And then when you flip over to the next page, he gets to go and rebuild the wall. And so he does this incredible organizational structure of rallying people up, and they're building the wall. And then if you fast forward a couple of chapters, you've got these two guys who come up to him, Sanballat and Tobias. I call him San and Tob. I think it's Tobias or Tobiah. I've called him Tob for too long.
Okay, sure.
It's one of them. Yeah.
Right.
And they basically say, lots of people are talking bad about you. You better come down here and defend yourself about it, which for a lot of us, we would take the bait of, yeah, I will go and defend myself. And he doesn't. He keeps building. Couple chapters later, they come back to him and they're sneakier of saying, why don't you just come have coffee and we'll talk about your plans? Maybe we have some ideas to help you. This is my paraphrase.
Right.
And he doesn't take that bait either. He says, I am doing a good work and I'm not coming down. And for me, it has been so anchoring to recognize what is my good work, because I can easily get mowed over with just how hard things are or complex, and what am I supposed to do? And so I have that, written here in my office, and even at home, I have it on my phone as a lock screen as I'm doing a good work and I'm not coming down. And for me, it's poverty. It's tackling that and children's health. And I can't tackle a lot more than that, but I know people who are tackling climate change or laws and, the criminal justice system. I also know people who are just moms. And I say just moms in the worst air quotes that I can, because there's never just a mom. But I mean, I had seasons like that too, right? Where I was just a mom. I wasn't doing anything global, I guess. And for that time, that was my good work. Mm-hmm. And so the wisdom is discerning what our good work is that we are not coming down for, and to leave the rest to the others and God, or befriend those people and try to partner with them, you know, academically. Mm-hmm. But I loved writing that chapter.
Yeah, it's good. And it's, well, I just think it's inspiring to see someone who has found their good work, you know,
yeah,
and who feels settled in it and focused. And it helps us all to say, oh, okay, this is possible. I can find mine.
Yeah. Academically, it helps to get out of the hustle. Because for me, if I'm going for a grant or writing a paper, or I have another opportunity, if it doesn't fit in my good work bucket, mm-hmm. and I have that defined a little bit more nuanced of what that actually means, then I just say no to it. And so it's helped be efficient, and I think maybe even faithful of what I should go for or not. And in the pandemic, I saw that too, because I had some opportunities to talk against Christian nationalism, since that was the group coming after me. And I did for a little bit. And then I just decided not to take any of those podcasts or calls or talking points anymore. Because 5 years after that, I'd be doing more of that talk instead of, you know, the poverty work that I'm doing. Right. Yeah.
That focus is, it's a beautiful thing.
I don't always get it right, but that has helped me.
Well, that's good. It's a good model for us. Let's move to talk a little bit more specifically about women in academic and professional contexts and how they might enjoy and use this book in their lives. And one of the things that I found really fascinating about this book, and also about your writing during the pandemic, was the way you are able to translate complex topics for ordinary readers. And I'm curious to know what that is like for you. Do you enjoy that? And do you have any tips for doing that kind of thing?
I loved doing it. I think I, you know, when I started the Facebook page at the beginning of the pandemic, I did it to just try to explain what R-naught or flatten the curve and all that stuff meant to people, because it really mattered. You know, I mean, it was just, I think we forget how scary that was to families. So try to explain that. And then when we were home, you know, we talked about flattening the curve with the Hot Wheel videos I made with my kids. We had to take it down because of the threats, but I loved translating it because it was what people needed to understand. And I think it's still why I wrote the book too, of if we can understand these topics for what they really are, it helps us be better neighbors. Mm-hmm. So that's why I did it. Maybe some tips for it is just write like you talk, and write it all down on paper, and then see if it makes sense to your aunt or your grandma or your friend who is certainly not a scientist. But I also think that it's made me a better scientific writer, because my academic articles seem to flow easier and I can write them quicker now. I think it's because I took the pressure off myself to sound so like I knew what I was exactly talking about, to I want people to know what this data means in real life.
Yeah.
So good. I've really enjoyed it.
And I think I can tell. You seem like, in your writing, you seem like you're having a lot of fun.
I do. Thank you. I do. I've always loved to write. So I'm glad that that translates a little bit.
Yeah. Well, at the very end of the book, you have an appendix with some really practical tips. And I was, you know, does one of those stand out as something you'd like to suggest to our listeners?
Yes, I have. The publisher asked if I would do a list of my favorite books. You know, if you want to be a good neighbor globally, what does that mean? Or not even globally, but here in the States. And I'm enough of a reader that I couldn't do the top 10. So it's the top 10-ish books. So people can look at that, you know, for other starting places. And then the other appendix is really practical. So what do you do on a Tuesday at home with family or at the workplace to become a better neighbor? And that's just stuff that I've done with my kids. You know, get a map, put it on the fridge. When you hear about Yemen in the news, then go find it on the map and circle it. And we love Google Earth. And so we'll go find Yemen on Google Earth and go through the streets. And with the nature of my work, I can, take them to Tanzania, but we can't go to places like Gaza, where we have some work done as well. So we can go and age appropriately, read the news and then look at the Google Earth there. Post-it notes. I also have get you some post-it notes. And if you hear a different language being spoken around you, ask what it is and write it down. And then talk about that with your kids at the table. And yeah, I think that gets in their bones the earlier that we can show them what neighboring instead of othering looks like just in normal life.
Yeah, I mean, you demonstrate kind of an open curiosity, and I mean, you
Right.
can tell that you're such a learner, and that enthusiasm is infectious
Oh, good.
in a
Well, and
good
I
way.
hope it, yes, and I hope it is for the kids, for my kids too, it's not like they are from another country. What country are they from? Let's honor that. And I think it helps get othering out of the kids that unfortunately can become unconscious to a lot of us.
Well, are there any other things that you would like to highlight, particularly for women in academia, from your work or from your book?
I think just coming into our own of who we are uniquely in spaces that aren't made for that. There's a lot of glass ceilings that still need to be permeated through, and existing in that system is hard. So, if anything, it's just to find people around you that can encourage you in that.
Yeah, that's good. No, we've covered a lot of ground here, so this has been great. As we wrap up, how can readers follow you and your work, and kind of what's coming up for you? What's on the horizon?
I'm still on social, so Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, kind of. So you can follow me there for
With
intermittent
boundaries.
hubby. Yes, with a lot of boundaries. Yeah. I do most of my writing these days on Substack as a long form newsletter. I do what's called a Neighbor Tuesday. Just how do we do this on a normal Tuesday? How do we neighbor well in the world? And so people can look at that and subscribe, and we'll see what's on the horizon. I'd love to do another book. I've loved writing a book. This is my first one, and I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. So if anybody is thinking about it, maybe encourage you to go for it.
Sure, that's great. That's
We'll
great.
see. Yeah.
Wow. Well, this has been such a great conversation. Was there anything that you wanted to get to that we didn't?
I wonder if we could talk about the Dr. Kahn
Yeah,
story, the Ebola
sure.
one. That seems to be one that people really resonate with.
Yeah, please tell us.
Okay. There is a part in the courage section about how to live this life of neighboring. And some of that is redefining what we call health or not and who gets what. And I tell this story of Dr. Kahn, and this is back in during the Ebola crisis, in the 2010s. And Dr. Kahn, to put it in some perspective, he was the Dr. Fauci of Africa. People knew who he was for sure. He had also been advocating with some global health rock stars like Dr. Paul Farmer here at Congress to bolster up the African continent with pandemic response, just in case something like Ebola or COVID was going to hit. And then, unfortunately, Ebola did hit West Africa where he was, and they didn't have the infrastructure, although they'd been trying at Congress to get it. And so lots and lots of people got sick. I'm sure everybody remembers that time. The 50% of healthcare workers who got Ebola were women. I'm sorry, 50% of those who died were women. So it were the women healthcare workers. And then he came down with Ebola. And we know that Ebola is extremely contagious. It is not that deadly, though. It's misconstrued as being deadly. It's only fatal if you don't have the infrastructure medical around you to support that. So he deteriorated very quickly. They transferred him to a MSF, a Doctors Without Borders facility that was kind of equipped, a little bit more equipped for taking care of him. And then he kept getting worse, and they had to make this decision if they were going to give him an experimental drug called ZMapp. And that's, the vaccine, but it was very experimental at that time. And so there were discussions, I'm sure fraught with lots of complex, what do we do? And the reason is there were only three or four vials of that in the world, one of which will what which was at his facility that he was at. So it was decided not to give him one. The New York Times went into detail on the nuances of that if you want to go into it. But a couple days later, he ended up passing away at that facility, and his family wasn't allowed to come in. A friend was finally allowed to go in at the very end. Around that same time, in a neighboring country, another doctor got sick with Ebola. Same thing, very sick, deteriorated, needed to be medevaced out. He did get medevaced out to the US, and he received ZMapp. Now, Dr. Khan was actually given a medevac from the country, but they wouldn't take him because he was so sick, and that plane wasn't equipped with the HEPA filters and the things you see on the news to keep everybody else safe. The other doctor was American. He was at an organization that had some very deep pockets and incredible connections with very high up agencies, political leaders. And I was specific in not naming him, but wanting to name Dr. Kwan to keep the centering correct. Because if it were any of our family members, if that had gotten sick, I would do heaven and earth. I'd move it to try to get my family member to a medical facility that could take care of it. So you bet I would try to get that medevac and get them here in the States. That doctor would end up walking out of the hospital a couple of weeks fine. He lived. So the 30,000-foot question as a neighbor is, who gets what? What is the value and worth of a life, and whose are worth more than the other? If you take that to a country level, that works there too. What country is deemed worthy as getting COVID vaccines? 80% of those were gobbled up by high-income countries. Health infrastructure, when the British or the colonial powers left, what was left in those countries? So I think tackling that and wrestling it with that makes us a better neighbor because we, especially as a person of faith, can say, well, all are worthy, kind of with our taking our shoes off because the ground is holy, and then working towards making that a reality here on earth. I think it's a powerful story to anchor us.
Emily's ability to look at huge global challenges without flinching and determine how God is calling her to contribute is a beautiful model. I'm grateful for Emily's work and her example of the integration of faith, work, and life. I hope you check out her book, which you can find wherever books are sold. And if you listen to the end of the credits, you'll get to hear a bonus from our podcast where Emily talks about thriving as a woman in science. The Women Scholars and Professionals podcast is hosted by me, Anne Boyd, and is a production of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. We acknowledge that the opinions of our guests may not necessarily represent the ministry, doctrine, or policies of InterVarsity. You can find more information about our podcast and the other cool things we are doing at thewell.intervarsity.org. Our work is funded solely through the donations of our listeners and supporters, so if you enjoyed this podcast, you might consider joining our support team by donating even $10 per month. You can find out how to do this at our website. To ensure others will find and enjoy our podcast as well, please consider rating and reviewing our podcast and sharing it with others. And as we close, listen in on this excerpt from my conversation with Emily. I want to turn our conversation to talk about your journey as a woman in science, which I found to be a very fascinating element of your book. You write about some people who really believed in you and then other examples of people who didn't really expect much from you. And I loved in the acknowledgments, you have a long list of women you're thanking. You have some people called the nerdy girls, which I thought was really fun. And then, but then in the text of the book, you write about your high school science fair and that there was something that happened there. So I bet our listeners would love to hear that story. And maybe if you could talk about that in the context of this question of what has helped you to thrive as a woman in science.
I love this conversation. You know, this by far has been the most surprising story that has resonated with people in the book.
Wow.
I just thought I was going to put it in because it's part of my story, but there's that story and the Ebola one are the ones I get emails about. And I'm just tickled pink about it because it's the one that you're talking about, the Science Fair project. So that teacher that gave me the genetic textbook also hooked me up with a professor at Texas Tech University. And it was about an hour and a half away from me because we just didn't have a science program at my high school. And it was in a neurophysiology lab, like as lab bench science as you could get. And he put me with Dr. Schrallendorf is her name. So I worked with her on a summer project for 3 years. And then, during the school year, she would send me home with an electrophoresis machine to take to my high school, which I just and analyze data there, like
Oh, wow.
DNA. Hilarious. But I was hooked. I just loved it. So the pinnacle of what I wanted to do was to go to the International Science and Engineering Fair. And the first step to do that was to go, to the regional fair and the state science fair. So I get to the regional and I brought my huge board. If you get the physical book, you can see a picture of that board.
Yes, it's great.
Oh, it's on something because it is steroid city. My dad made it out of plywood and it has, places where I could put more data in it. I couldn't carry it because it was so big. So he had to come with me. But I noticed at that regional science fair that the judges weren't coming up. And I didn't know why because it was such a good project and it was for a regional fair. Finally, I had this female judge come up at the end of the day and just say, I just wanted you to know that all the judges got together and she was the only female or one of the only ones. And they just said, there's no way that a 16-year-old blonde girl could do this project. So, basically I had plagiarized and I was devastated. So I lost that one and just kind of told my parents and my mentor, Dr. Mrs. Dodd, I'm not doing it anymore. And so they gave me some time to kind of, lay low in that. And then Miss Dodd said, why don't you try another competition? It's a different mechanism. And so after a while I said yes, and finally went to that when my mom would take me. But it was such an imposter syndrome to just try again, because I thought, who in the world is gonna let me thrive essentially here or believe that I did the work? I had a huge three-ring binder that I printed off all the experiments just to make sure I've got it documented.
Oh my
And
gosh, yeah.
I would go on to win that one and win their international competition in London, which paid for a great scholarship. So it worked out well. But the misogyny that you experience, I think, especially in high school, that you didn't even know to call it misogyny,
Right.
it's really difficult. So I'm grateful for parents and for Ms. Dodd to say, why don't you try again and let's keep going.
Wow, it's such
So
a
I
good
think,
story.
oh, thank you. I think to your question of how do you thrive as a woman, I think some of it is just getting other women around you. Misogyny hasn't gone away at all.
Right.
I'm tall and I'm blonde, and there's nothing I can do about that. But I think having other people around you that when they hear misogyny at conferences that you're presenting at, and they can stand up, I've seen it happen before where women at the podium are interrupted by men. I'm sure a lot of people have at science conferences, and women from the audience will just stand up and call it out and say, give her back the mic.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think that's the way to thrive is to get colleagues around you that can see it and empathize and point it out and, help you do something about it.
Yeah.
Oh, can I say something else about
Oh, go
that
ahead.
story?
Sure,
The part that I get emails from that particular story and chapter, at the end of the chapter, I tell the story again about the judges saying I'm a 16-year-old blonde. One of them mentioned to the female judge, she looks more like a model than a scientist. And so at the end, I have this line that says, I would go on to be a model, but this time it's multivariate regression on poverty dimensions for children's health. I mean, something's really nerdy. People have loved that line, which makes me laugh because that's just not my personality to put something like that in there, but I put it in there.
It's great. It's a little sassy. It's a little
Yeah.
nerdy. It's
Yes.
perfect.
It's a little sarcastic. It's a, I gotcha type.